Film Spotting is brought to you by the new PeerFlix.com, a fun place to get movies for less.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And from Milwaukee, I'm Sam Van Halgren. On this week's show, our top five films about stalkers, voyeurs, and peeping toms.
Plus Massacre Theater, listener feedback, new music from Graham Parker, and the first film in our six-week silent films marathon, Birth of a Nation.
But first, Adam and I take a look at this year's Oscar winner for Best Foreign Language Film, The Lives of Others. The first time many people became acquainted with Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck's debut film, The Lives of Others, was when it won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film over presumed favorite, Pan's Labyrinth. But despite their obvious differences, Pan's Labyrinth is an adult fairy tale and The Lives of Others is an allegorical period piece, the movies have striking similarities. Both films take place in oppressive regimes, fascist Spain and Cold War East Berlin. Both films feature a combination of allegory and realism, and both films are, on some level, about disobedience and the transformative power of art. The Lives of Others does take place in East Berlin in the mid-80s at the tail end of the Cold War. A Stasi agent, Gerd Wiesler, played by Ulrich Mühe, is assigned to monitor the apartment of a well-known playwright, Georg Dreimann, and his girlfriend, Christa Maria Seeland, because Dreimann is suspected of engaging in subversive activities. What Wiesler learns about Dreimann and Seeland has a profound impact on all three of them. Adam, we both loved Pan's Labyrinth. It was in your top 10 of the year. I think I snuck it on as my number 11 film of 2006. And we were both surprised and maybe even a little disappointed when it failed to win the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar. So I guess my question is, now that you've seen The Lives of Others, if you had been eligible to vote for this year's Best Foreign Language Film, which depiction of an oppressive regime would you have gone with? Guillermo del Toro's Spanish fascism or von Donnersmarck's East German communism?
Well, not that the Oscars probably mean a whole lot in the grand scheme of things when it comes to judging a film, but you quite astutely pointed out last week on the show that you can't read too much into the Oscar win for Lives because the foreign language Oscar is based on a vote that only people who see the movie at one of five official screenings can participate in. So it's not really an indictment of Lives to suggest that Pan's Labyrinth should have won, considering all the other nominations it got. Had it been a normal vote, I think it's fair to say that it surely would have won.
Sure.
And if I had a vote, I would have still given it to Pan's Labyrinth, which, again, it was one of my top 10 films of the year. I would have given it to Pan's mainly because I was sucked into Guillermo del Toro's world and never really unleashed from it. And my ability to suspend disbelief in this adult fairy tale that you mentioned never wavered. And with Lives, my ability to suspend disbelief did waver a little bit, and for reasons I'll get into later. But that said, I really liked this film, mainly because I was fascinated by the parallel the movie draws between Wiesler, the spy, the guy who is surveilling the playwright, and the playwright, Georg Dreimann. Dreimann's a director friend who has been blacklisted. He can't direct plays anymore, is seen as a subversive. He's been, I think, out of work for like 9 years or something. He has a line where he says something about how a director without words is nothing. The image is nothing without text. Yeah. And Wiesler, by surveilling Dreimann's apartment, is basically playing a director. He's using the words he's been given that he hears. And not only, as we see later, is he creating his own version of events, but he's actually directing the action. He starts to influence the events and see how the characters are going to respond. And I think probably the most blatant example of that, of course, is when he orchestrates it so that Dreimann has to confront the fact that his girlfriend is somehow involved with a government minister. And he's being a writer here. He's being a director. He's taking two characters, he's creating a situation for them, and he's letting the drama unfold. And I think, too, what was really fascinating about the film is the fundamental question it poses about the role of the artist. Wiesler, as an artist, even though, of course, he's not really, he works for the Stasi, he's a police officer in some way, he has to decide how much to get involved or whether simply to go about his work writing these sterile accounts of what he sees and hears, just as Dreimann has to finally decide whether he's going to continue being just a safe artist. Is he going to just be that writer who one person refers to him earlier as the only non-subversive writer the GDR has, whether he's going to get involved and try to affect change or keep on being just that safe writer. And so those questions about art and the way you watch that parallel between this guy who's clearly not an artist basically become one, that was really fascinating to me.
Well, it's a fascinating point. It's not something that occurred to me. But you're right. I mean, I did bring up this concept of the transformative power of art, which certainly is the subject of the film. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to note that the effect that art and artists do have on Wiesler, the Stasi agent, is really one of the surprising elements of the film, because when we're first introduced to him, it's as if we're being introduced to the very model of a perfect Stasi mm-hmm. agent, completely emotionally detached from his subjects, really is, the foremost agent of the state, really. I mean, that's what we're led to believe about him, and the power that that really his surveillance of this artist and patriot in some ways really has an effect on him is one of the most sort of potent parts of this film. I'll answer my own question now as far as if I had a vote for the best foreign language films of 2006. Honestly, I would go with The Lives of Others. In fact, I'd have to put this at number two, actually, on the best films of 2006. If
we really?
Sort of rejigger our list. And it had everything to do with the payoff of the film. And I want to say here, if you're listening, I know we're probably 6 or 7 minutes into this review, but the less you know about this film before you go into it, the better. I really think that. I really knew very little. I had assumptions about what the film was about. I mean, if you'd mm-hmm. seen any kind of trailer, you got a sense that, yes, we have this Stasi agent conducting surveillance on this couple. And the idea was, well, certainly this couple is going to have some impact on him. But my impression was that it was more or less going to be his resentment in having to conduct surveillance on somebody that has an emotionally rich relationship in some mm-hmm. way. The movie is far, far more complicated than that. And I think by the end of the film, really the last 30 minutes of the film had such an impact on me where there isn't an ideal situation that can happen. There are moments in the film where you can't imagine that anything good could come of it, mm-hmm. and yet you hope for it anyway.
Right.
The situations are so complex in terms of what people want out of a situation I found myself experiencing a level of tension and anxiety and also kind of joy and bittersweet relief through the entire film that I really have to say that just the impact of the film allowed me to overlook some of the problems that I had earlier in the film.
Okay.
In the kind of way, the allegory, in a way, or the kind of parallels between the Stasi agent and the artists, there's a sense of it being overwritten a little bit, where there's a kind of ironies that develop in terms of mm-hmm. Who we can trust and who we can keep secrets with, and the effect of art. At one point, Dreimann's, is playing the piano, and he brings up this this anecdote about Stalin listening to Beethoven and says that, if I keep listening to this, I'll never finish the revolution. Mm-hmm. And then makes some note about anybody that can really hear beautiful music can't possibly be a bad person. And of course, this is an obvious reference to the Stasi agent that is listening to their conversation. Some of those things hit home a little hard, but I have to say, again, the way this film is constructed, mm-hmm. by the end, the payoff is just tremendous.
Well, I agree that some of those moments, I had that same reaction to that same moment. Some of those moments are overwritten. I think the themes are a little bit too on the nose. But we had a different experience, I think, in that opening half of the film was actually much more interesting to me than the last 30 minutes or so. And I'm not saying that the tension isn't there, but when I talk about my inability to keep my disbelief suspended, the problem is when you get to the last half hour of the film, and I agree with you completely, I don't want to say too much about this film. The less you know, the better. I'm going to be as vague as possible here. I swear I'm not going to give anything away. But I never completely bought the transformation, first of all, that has to take place. And you talked about the transformative power of art. I never completely bought it because the encounters that Wiesler has with art, the sonata he hears, reading Brecht, they're not enough for me to believe that they're going to undo how this guy is hardwired. You mentioned earlier his moments of being this perfect agent. I mean, when he meets Georg Dreimann for the first time and they're saying, hey, he's a great writer, he's one of our best, and his initial reaction, I mean, he's just like, it's like he's been programmed, is we should have him surveilled.
Yeah.
You know, he just knows how to do his job. He's the consummate professional. But I never really believed then that the art that we see him exposed to would change him in the way it does. And the movie never convinced me, frankly, that Dreiman is a truly great artist. The snippets of his play that we see, the piece that he writes that kind of propels the last half of the film, that didn't really work for me. And I think by the time we get to the end, just in terms of the plot, frankly, I thought the ending was unnecessarily confusing in terms of one really blatant miscommunication between two characters. The entire ending also hinges on one act, and it's an act I don't believe Wiesler would ever have been in a position to complete. And again, I know some people might call these nitpicks, but for me, they completely brought me out of the moment. I mean, maybe on a spoiler edition of this show sometime, I can explain exactly what I mean, but I'm telling you, all of a sudden, the tension started to just kind of ooze out of the moment, because I'm saying, wait a second, that wouldn't have happened like that. I did have those moments, unfortunately.
Well, it reminded me of a Kieslowski film in some way, or his films in general, where I really had at some point to accept the allegorical nature of the film. You know, certain things were going to have to take place. I would have to accept certain coincidences to take place or certain events to have to take place. And these transformative moments I just had to go with. And I did. Mm-hmm. I really did. And that's why the movie ended up being so powerful, I think. Because the movie is not only is it about this transformative power of art, it's also about betrayal on a number of levels.
Yeah.
His Stasi agent is betrayed in some way by the state that he believes in.
Yeah.
Just as much as, you know, the artist is in some way betrayed by fellow artists and in just this nature of loyalty to the state.
Yeah.
I think really it's not that, you know, the Stasi agent is moved at first by the art. He's first moved by the artist's loyalty to the state.
Yeah,
I
that's
think
true.
That's why it works out. I think that does justify many things that happen in the film. And before we wrap this up, I do want to say that Ulrich Mühe is – I don't know if you saw when von Donnersmarck actually accepted the award for Best Foreign Language Film. At the end of his speech, he actually says, no matter what anybody else says, Ulrich, you are the greatest actor in the world, or
nice.
Something to that effect. And I have to say, I don't disagree after seeing
this
film.
Yeah, he's great.
The physical control he has over this part, which is just a manifestation of his interior life, is astounding. What he does, the acting he does with his eyes, it is just a great, great film performance.
Yeah, it is. And you know, at one point, Dreiman has some narration where he talks about the gray men who protect their safety. And he is that gray man. He is a guy who wears the same outfit, this grayish-green coat that literally allows him to blend in anywhere. I started to notice, why is he wearing the same outfit all the time? And he's the ultimate conformist. And there are shades of Bertolucci here. But,
Know,
whether he's outside standing behind a gray building or he's in his apartment where he blends in with all the light green and brown decor, he doesn't stand out. Nothing about him stands out. He literally can blend in and you cannot even know that he's there. And I think it is a brilliant performance in addition to all the other set design and everything that goes into that. And my last point I loved about the film, and because I want to make it clear, I did really love the film despite it slipping for me by the end, is that von Donnersmarck really understands the importance of context to art. You know, Dreiman's play has meaning in one context or several possible meanings and then changes completely during a later point in the film when we see it performed again. And this whole idea that von Donnersmarck is willing to put out there that art somehow needs political upheaval, needs revolution in order to really strive. I mean, what would art be like in a utopia? If everything was perfect, if art couldn't be subversive, right, what would you have? And so if you don't have at least two sides with very clear agendas opposing each other, dialectics, to quote your boy Ryan Gosling from Half Nelson, then you've got nothing. Art needs conflict. It needs pain and suffering in some way, and I think that's a fascinating topic as well. So I did really like the film, and I think everyone should check it out. If it's anywhere near them, it is playing, of course, only in limited release, unfortunately, right now.
That's right. Well, if you've seen The Lives of Others and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
It's time for a quick break. When we come back, your thoughts on Zodiac, and Sam and I try to quell the rebellion we stirred after revealing the films we're most embarrassed to admit we've never seen. Stay with us.
Hurricanes are howling up the Florida coast, leaving the beach towns as dead as a ghost. 24 inches of rain in a matter of days. The governor says that it's God's will, that's what he says. Mudslides are running down the hill to the town, knocking the telegraph poles to the ground.
panic in Pennsylvania. That's what they fear. But this has nothing to do with what we're putting in the atmosphere. Good things are coming if we stick to the plan. Good things are coming if we stick to the plan. Stick to the plan. You gotta stick to the plan. I'll keep your finger on the trigger. Stick to the plan. Well, don't pay no attention to what the experts say. Too much intelligence gets in the way. Yeah, it gets in the way.
I think we just passed a filling station.
It was closed.
Do you always go around helping people in the night?
When I'm done with them, they don't need much help.
Shh, it's okay.
Before I kill you, I'm going to throw your baby out the window.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and that was a clip from the movie Zodiac, David Fincher's latest movie. That's Ione Skye in the car,
yeah,
discovering that she is taking a ride with the Zodiac killer himself. A very creepy scene in a very creepy movie, and we discussed it last week on the show. But Sam, we felt a little bit like we didn't quite get out everything we wanted to say about the movie. Maybe even there was a little bit of confusion about how we finally came out on the film, whether right. or not we liked it or disliked it. We definitely both liked it. Yeah. I certainly liked it more than you did. And actually, I think one of our emailers here, we want to jump into the mailbag. One of our emailers, I think, definitely nailed how I feel about the film. So why don't we start with that one?
Yeah, that's Coria Todd, who writes, "When I walked out of Zodiac, the first thing I realized about my reaction to the film was that I had become Jake Gyllenhaal's Graysmith character. Every single scene with the three main characters is kept interesting because you are being hit with both tons of evidence and information and character development and quirks at the same time. The film, though long, was not too long. It was the perfect length. Every scene seemed important, and the flow that Fincher created over the 2 hours and 40 minutes was flawlessly fast-paced. There was just the right mix of character, police procedure, and conspiracy theory to keep my mind running long after I came out of the theater. I would say that Zodiac is up there with Seven and Fight Club as Fincher's best, and I can't wait to see it again and catch all the little puzzle pieces I may have missed. Keep up the great show." That's Corey Atad. So, Adam,
yeah,
reflecting your reaction to the film, yeah.
Yeah, Corey, with a great email there, really, I think, did kind of sum up my feelings about it, where I felt like Fincher's meticulousness and his obsessiveness to detail ends up becoming our obsession, just like it is for the characters as well. You start looking at the frame, and there's so much in the frame that you start trying to pick out clues yourself. At least that's the way I felt, where trying to, in a way, solve the case myself. And so I think he makes a great point there. And I also think that if you're going to kind of sum it up in terms of where it stands with Fincher's body of work, I do like this movie enough that I would say it's not as good as Seven. I still love that film, but it's just as good as Fight Club, if not better. I know you're not a fan of Fight Club, famously, a movie you find overrated, but I would put it up there with Fincher's best that we've seen so far, without a doubt.
Well, we talked a lot about last week this feeling of discomfort that that Fincher likes to give his audiences. And your question last week was, you know, did you leave the film unsatisfied, as you imagine many people might? And I sort of left all of his films at various levels of dissatisfaction. Not entirely dissatisfied, but not entirely satisfied either. I leave kind of begrudgingly respecting the film in a lot of ways, but not with a lot of affection. And this was another case. And I think what I came around to, and maybe didn't articulate last week, was that even though Fincher is denying you some pleasure as an audience member, I mean, he's going out of his way to do that, maybe, and that's one of his goals. He isn't cynical, and in some ways, he's much more honest a filmmaker than a lot of mainstream filmmakers are. And I think that's why I'm left with such a respect for him. He really does respect his characters, and he respects his audience, and I, in turn, respect him for that.
Yeah, I agree completely, which brings us to a great post here in our message boards, actually, from Jeff Houston in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Jeff is our dope sheet editor, our weekly email blast. And after hearing some of his comments, I think you might understand why we asked Jeff to help us out with the dope sheet.
He's a very good writer.
He is a good writer. He's got some great thoughts here, and we're just taking a small portion of it here. And of course, if you ever have thoughts, you want to get into a longer discussion about the movies we're reviewing on the show, please feel free to go over to filmspotting.net/boards and check out our message boards. Jeff writes, And then there's just the general aesthetic itself, which distinctly captures a time and a place as well as any movie you'll see. Honestly, it doesn't merely look like a film about that time, but literally like one from that time. People wonder where the great 70s-style films have gone. Well, David Fincher just made one. And Zodiac Fincher strips away the style, so all that's left is the substance. And given how raw and searing it plays, how it truly gets under your skin, clearly this level of substance is not foreign territory for Fincher, because he's worked in it before, expertly, and here he does again. And as a result, Zodiac isn't merely a superior execution of the crime procedural that is often defined by serial killers and perverse deviants. It is an indictment of those crime procedurals that crassly exploit evil rather than examining it with sobriety. And that's Jeff Houston in Tulsa. And that is a great point. It's something that Fincher has commented on in interviews, that he didn't want to try to put the audience in the mind of a serial killer. He felt that was something that was irresponsible and probably impossible, and just wasn't right in terms of the victims of this case.
Right. No, I think it's a really good point. And I love his point about what you're left with in this film, maybe more so than others, is the substance. And I absolutely agree. There is a lot of substance to these films. But like I did say last week, I do think that Fincher does lack, and maybe I'm alone here, but I don't really feel like he gets to know his characters very well. Even if he's able to get under our skin through paranoia, I never felt like he has a really good sense of bringing characters to life on screen. And maybe that has something to do with the fact that he makes his actors do 75 to 100 takes of every single scene, which he's sort of famous for at this point. And there is a kind of lifelessness a little bit to the performances.
There is a sense that these characters, these actors, are cogs in a larger machine.
Right. But it's a fascinating machine.
Yeah, definitely a fascinating one. And I think Jeff makes a great point as well, something I had in my notes and we just didn't have time to get into, about how this film really is an indictment in some way of the crime procedural, not only in the fact that it doesn't in some way try to put us in the head of the serial killer, but in the way that the movie examines, I mentioned briefly last week, the Dirty Harry aspect of the film, where you've got a great line where Mark Ruffalo says, "So much for due process," right? I mean, it really does strip away everything we are accustomed to seeing in these types of films, including the resolve that we talked about that we don't get. So anyway, we both did definitely like Zodiac, and we appreciate all the feedback we got on our review, which brings us now, Sam, to the floodgates we opened up with our discussion, our top five last week of the movies we're most embarrassed to admit we've never seen. And we'd like to start off this portion of the mailbag here with a voicemail, actually, from a listener. This is Marco in New York, Sam, who, like many listeners, was in shock that you
outraged.
Had never seen Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. But maybe even more than that, he was shocked about the fact that you admitted to it. He's got some advice for you about how maybe you could have handled it.
You could have faked it. You could have dodged the shame if you'd only remembered the plot to A Bug's Life. It's absolutely the same movie. It's the same thing. Unqualified bumblers help prepare a village against imminent marauders. I think there's even a gag reel at the end of Criterion's disc of Seven Samurai with Toshiro Mifune saying, "To infinity and beyond." But, Sam, if you haven't seen A Bug's Life, I can't help you, man. I'm sorry.
You know, I have the Criterion edition of Seven Samurai, and I don't recall that outtake at the end of it with Toshiro.
You didn't look hard enough.
I thought you were going to say
you have the Criterion edition of Bug's Life.
No, I don't, actually. but it's on my Christmas list, without a doubt.
Right.
So let's get into some more responses here. We got a great one here. Why don't you take it, Sam, from Dan Cron?
Yeah, Dan Cron, who writes, like you noted, like so many, "You've never seen Seven Samurai? Oh, my God. You almost lost me on this one, but then I started to think of the movies I haven't seen yet and for which I have no real excuse. Yeesh. Here goes. Good thing this is only top five. There are more I could list." He's got Rocky at number five. Never have, probably should, but then I think that it beat Taxi Driver for Best Picture and I get mad, he writes.
Fair enough.
Number four, Titanic. Number three, The Wizard of Oz. He even notes that he's a huge Pink Floyd fan. I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means.
You don't get it, Sam?
No, of course I do. This is a family show, Adam.
That's true.
I don't know how you miss Wizard of Oz if you're a child.
That's
true. I feel like you're sort of forced to sit through it.
Yep.
He's also got on here, we're digging deep into shame territory now that we're familiar with. Number two, he's got Citizen Kane. And number one, Casablanca.
Wow.
Sighs, hangs head, and weeps, Dan writes.
as well he should, though we certainly feel Dan's pain. And it was nice to see so many listeners who responded like he did. Initially, they were a little bit outraged,
yeah, shocked,
or shocked,
outraged,
or disappointed. And then they went, oh, God, if I had to put together my list, it would be just as long, if not much longer. Apparently, our only listener who doesn't feel that way, of course, our nemesis, M. Robert Turnage, who has seen every film ever made. So congratulations.
Yes, we're
to
taunting you.
You,
elegant nemesis. That's exactly what we're doing.
Your film was Seven Samurai. The film that listeners responded to the most for me, the one they were most shocked with, was, I believe, my number four, might have been my number three, and that was Lawrence of Arabia. Chris, yeah, Hutton in Columbus, Ohio, starts off saying, after you guys said you hadn't seen Lawrence of Arabia, my body went into shock and my brain simply could not understand.
And just for the record, I have seen Lawrence of Arabia. Don't lump me in with Adam here.
That's right, but I'll put you on the spot in a second and ask you what you thought of it, Sam. Jolene Combs in Poughkeepsie, New York said, Adam, you've never seen Lawrence of Arabia, in all caps, I'll note. Do yourself a favor and go see it on a big screen. Lawrence is truly one of the most powerful film experiences I have ever had, and I've seen it close to 30 times.
That's unbelievable.
I saw this film for the first time in January 05 when I finally buckled down and rented it from Blockbuster. I was so entranced that I watched it every day for a week before returning it to the store. When I returned to school, I would rent this film every Friday night from the library and watch it every Friday night.
Now,
Sam,
Jolene claims that she's class of 07 at Vassar College, but by my calculations, her seeing it 30 times actually puts her at 35 or 40 years of age.
That's true.
It's 8.5 hours long, at least.
I know.
And that's the thing. I'm just waiting, like you, I think, or maybe that's what you're doing, Adam. You're waiting to see it on the big screen, and you just haven't had the chance.
Well, so many listeners wrote in and said that. They said, Adam, you can't just see it on your TV at home. You really do need to wait for some revival or something to see it on the big screen. So now I have a built-in excuse.
Right, exactly. All right. Well, our friend Matt Singer wrote in a couple that he's embarrassed that he's never seen. He has Le Cirque Rouge. He writes, I'm such a huge con man, heist movie fan, and yet I've barely seen any Melville. I mean, most people probably wouldn't care about seeing this movie, but when you're a big fan of the genre and on the cusp of practically being an expert on it, Matt writes, it's really pathetic for someone to say, oh, man, I love Le Cirque Rouge, and for you to have to go, yeah, Melville, awesome.
That is so great there, Sam, because that was kind of the whole point of us admitting to these lists, because we're tired of having to do that, of acting like, of pretending like, we've seen that one. You throw out an actor's name or a director's name, like you can talk with some intelligence about it when, of course, you can't. So we're trying to avoid that. So I loved reading that.
Yeah, and Matt also has on here, Adam, and you'll be happy to hear this, Lawrence of Arabia. Like you, I've never been able to commit the ridiculous amount of time required to see this movie. I've rented it at least once and not watched it, and it was on TCM last year, and I recorded it and got about 20 minutes in before I was so bored I turned it off. My roommate during grad school hated this movie and loved to take shots at it, and I think he may have tainted me. I'm beginning to think I will never see this movie.
Well, I understand his pain, definitely. I mean, it is one of those cases where it does seem so long, and like a lot of listeners pointed out too, there comes a point where I think one person on our list here had Gone with the Wind, of course, and they're like, you know what, it's been now so long that I've gone without seeing it, and it's such a long film that I'm just committed to not ever seeing it. But I'm trying to avoid that kind of cynicism with Lawrence of Arabia, and certainly the emails from our listeners help push me toward it. I'm looking forward to finally seeing it, hopefully on the big screen. We got a lot of great emails to go through here, Sam, and maybe in the next segment here or right before the top five, we'll jump in. We have to at least get to Lex's email with some suggestions for you, Sam, on which 80s movies you need to break down and see. But if you've got feedback for us, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net, or leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463.
We're going to take another quick break. When we come back, a lesson in how to speak screwball from Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon, and our silent movie marathon kicks off with a film that is indisputably both one of the greatest American films of all time and one of its most despised. Stay with us.
Every last drop will go into this now. I don't want to miss now. I don't know when to stop. I just pump and pump till that's all there is. You better stick to me just like glue now. You better stick to me. Race against time is what I'm into. Hey now, get through on the hotline of people's voices screaming the choices. You better stick to me just like the moon now. You better stick to me. That's what to do now.
First thing tomorrow, we go out to the dog track and put the whole bundle on Greased Lightning.
Greased Lightning? You're going to bet my money on a dog?
He's a shoo-in. I got it from Max the Waiter. His brother-in-law is the electrician. The Y is the rabbit.
What are you giving me with a rabbit?
Look at the odds. He's 10-1 tomorrow. We'll pay everybody.
Suppose he loses.
What are you worried about? This job is going to last a long time.
Suppose it doesn't.
Cherry boy, why do you have to paint everything so black?
Oh.
Suppose you got hit by a truck. Suppose the stock market crashes. Suppose Mary Pickford divorces Douglas Fairbanks.
Suppose the Dodgers leave Brooklyn.
Joe?
Suppose Lake Michigan overflows.
Well, don't look now, but the whole town is underwater.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I destroy a beloved screenplay, and you get a chance to win a free DVD. Last week, Adam and I massacred the scene you just heard from Billy Wilder's classic, Some Like It Hot, a tie-in with last week's top five movies we're embarrassed we've never seen. And actually, for the record, Adam, we have both seen Some Like It Hot, but we thought it's one of those classic films that many people have maybe likely overlooked and are embarrassed about it. I did, though, admit to having never seen Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity. I know it's a favorite of yours, and it actually was playing in this great art house, the Time Cinema, 5 minutes from where I work, and it only played for 3 nights. I had to see The Lives of Others instead, couldn't get to it. I had a friend in from out of town. It was like a sign that I ignored. I don't know if I'll be punished for that.
I can't believe you ignored it. I thought for sure when you told me about the fact that it was playing, I thought for sure you'd be coming back to the show telling us all about how you had seen it.
Yeah. I was like, in your face. Look at that. Look at it. It's fate intervening, and I ignored fate. I think Bergman could probably make a film about that, actually, me ignoring fate. All right, we'll reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Lindsay McCray from Fairfax, Virginia. Congratulations, Lindsay. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
I'll say action, Eddie. That'll be your cue, right? You come through the door, you walk right over here to the desk, to Amber, and shoot.
We're on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and Sam, I'm not sure that this is necessarily a beloved screenplay. I don't even know how much we love this film, but I think we both like it. It is a good film, definitely by a good director in my mind, and it ties in very clearly with our top five this week. We'll get to in the next segment, Voyeurs, People Being Watched. The movie definitely deals with that. I think that's all we probably need to say here.
Oh, yeah.
So you kick it off, so I will give you the action. And action.
I gotta get out.
Sure, and go where?
Australia.
No kidding? Where is Australia exactly? Near England?
See, here, this is Queens. All the way around here, Australia. You can't get any further away before you start coming back. You know, there's still places in Australia where no human being has ever set foot.
So when are you leaving?
Well, it's not that simple. It takes money. Planning. You can't just get up and go. I'm going to do it. Don't worry about that. I just got to move slow. Pick a moment. Bonus time's coming around the corner. As soon as I get a retaining wall built on the back of the house, I can start thinking about selling up, and I'll be gone. Up and away on that big steel bird. I'm going. Don't you worry about that.
I never knew anybody who got out.
And scene.
All right, if you know what film Sam and I just massacred, send us an email by Tuesday, March 14th to feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's show. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, just visit filmspotting.net.
They send me in my heart. There's evil in the world. But when I got no one, I talk to God. I ask for strength. Ask for forgiveness, not peace at the end of my days when I got no more life to live or no more good to do, but today, right now.
That's a clip from Black Snake Moan, which opened last week. No, not Sam Jackson, but the great John Cothran Jr. And Sam, we got an interesting voicemail over the weekend from Thomas in Nashville, a Christian, a person of faith, who saw Black Snake Moan solely on our recommendation, ended up loving it, thinks it's an amazing story of redemption and a true Christian movie, which I found really interesting. And here's the most interesting part about it. I happened to read over the weekend an article in the Chicago Tribune about Christian film critics, and it focused on one in particular who, at the time the article starts, is reviewing the Peter O'Toole movie Venus.
Oh, Venus,
and he is literally giving it scores based on its vulgarity. I mean, he's giving it like a score, a point score for its entertainment value, and then point totals for its crassness and its language and all of that. And so it really is a matter of these Christian critics judging a film based on its morality content versus its entertainment value.
Like a score sheet kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm thinking how ridiculous this is and how stupid it is because, of course, how could they like any movie then like A Black Snake Moan? Because they couldn't get past the language and the sex and the violence and all that stuff. And so then I get later in the article, as I'm thinking this, they come back to this critic who admits that his favorite film of 2005 was Hustle and Flow.
Wow.
So apparently Craig Brewer has really tapped in to Christianity in some way. And these stories of redemption,
that's right.
Yeah, they definitely are. We talked to him about it at Sundance, and I am not surprised, I guess, in the end, because, you know, Brewer said it. He understands where these people come from and the importance of religion in their lives, and he doesn't denigrate or ridicule Christianity or
not
religion in any way. He definitely values it. And so I think that's interesting. I thought that was a great voicemail we got from Thomas. I'm so glad that he liked the movie, and I'm very glad with the way our poll results came out, Sam. We asked people, Craig Brewer's Black Snake Moan, ... I can't wait. I'm skeptical but curious. I'm skeptical but will wait for DVD. Or Nymphos in Chains, simply not for me. How did it come out?
Well, 40% of you, I guess the power of film spotting, the power of you and I, Adam.
Maybe.
40% of listeners said that they can't wait. They can't wait to see Black Snake Moan. 38% said skeptical but curious. 15% skeptical will wait for DVD. And only 7% admit that Nymphos in Chains are just not for them. Very, very small minority. Nymphos in Chains, everyone else loves.
Everyone else loves, including us, of course. And so you're right. 78%, though, of our listeners are saying they're going to go out and see this film. And we already have received a few responses, like Thomas in Nashville, and hopefully we'll get a few more and can discuss our listeners' takes on a future show. But now we have a new poll question, Sam, building up to this film, 300.
Yeah,
and
300.
You came up with this great question, I think, that says, the creators of Dawn of the Dead 04, the remake, and Sin City are behind this new film, 300. You're like,
I'll be there in loincloth and armor. CGI isn't really my bag, but I'm curious, or looks like my version of hell. Adam, where were you on that at this point?
I think I'm right in the middle, even though there's something about the film. I mentioned it several shows ago that the constant shouting of the word Sparta alone was enough to kind of turn me off from this film. But I did love Sin City, and this is another Frank Miller adaptation, so I'm definitely curious about it, and I am kind of excited to see it.
Yeah, I think I'm on the record, maybe on that same show, as saying like nothing looked less appetizing to me than 300.
But you've changed your tune.
I have changed my tune, and I think I told you this. I was at Barnes & Noble on another mission, another film spotting related mission. I was trying to track down a better copy of Birth of a Nation than the one I had in my possession. And I was on my way out of there, having failed my mission, and saw the graphic novel of 300, Frank Miller's 300. I looked pretty small. I picked it up and ended up reading the whole thing, just standing there in front of a bookshelf. And I got kind of stoked about seeing it. I have to admit, I was I was won over by the end of it. There were certain things that I was certainly like, this is clearly the same guy that wrote the graphic novel for Sin City. I mean, it's very much there. But there was something really interesting about this whole notion of these people fighting for this belief. And then that got me from looks like my version of hell. I read the graphic novel. Now I'm really up there where I'm basically strapping on my loincloth, basically, at this point.
Wow.
Then another turn, I ended up seeing Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead, the director of 300. I saw his 04 remake of Dawn of the Dead, and I was underwhelmed. I didn't hate it, but I was really underwhelmed. And now I'm lumped in. I'm back with you, Adam.
Okay.
CGI, I think I've talked about this. It's not really my bag, but I am curious. I will go into this film with curiosity.
You've actually run the gamut here from looks like my version of hell to I'll be there in loincloth and armor, and now back to just in the middle. CGI
is
really my bag.
Earlier on, I was mocking people that were looking forward to it, I think.
Yeah, but now you're curious.
I'm curious.
There you have it. Sam Van Halgren is curious about 300. Can't wait to hear your thoughts, Sam, on the misogyny of
Oh, yeah. I don't even know if there
scenes.
Are any women in this film, but naturally, misogyny will be a huge component of it.
You're hearing music from D.W. Griffith's 1915 film, Birth of a Nation, number 44 on the AFI's 100 Greatest American Movies list. And Sam, you know we love it when our listeners do the heavy lifting for us. And we have an email here from a new listener, John Hollum in Richardson, Texas, who writes to us, "I was able to watch Birth of a Nation a few months ago and am eagerly awaiting your take. Perhaps you can help me figure out this split personality of a film. On the one hand, it is highly regarded for its technical innovations, and there were several scenes that were quite impressive, and John singles out the Lincoln assassination sequence and also the editing in the finale. But John says, on the other hand, the film's racism is appalling, and that same finale that was edited so well was designed to make the viewer root for the KKK. Well, Sam, John mentioned the film's technical innovations, and this film is widely regarded as the first narrative film and the first blockbuster. They had to charge an unheard of, at the time, $2 per ticket to make up for the huge production costs. Wow. And it's the movie that essentially invented modern film language, the first movie to use iris shots, night photography, panning shots, and cross-cutting between scenes, and a host of other pioneering techniques. And yet, not only is the racism appalling, it may be the single most racially offensive piece of mainstream art ever.
Ever.
So the question then is, to you, are the artistic achievements of Birth of a Nation enough to compensate for its ideology, or, to borrow a phrase from Roger Ebert, can you separate the content from the craft?
Boy, I mean, split personality, which John calls it, is probably the best way to look at it. And I guess you'd have to have a split personality in order to ignore. I mean, appalling racism is the understatement of the greatest understatement of all time. It really is shocking after shocking moment, particularly in the second half of the film. You and I had a quick conversation as you were at about the halfway mark, and you weren't even really into the deeply, deeply racist depictions that really unfold in the second half of the film. That being said, I was enthralled by the film.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really was. The film is nearly 3 hours. It was made in 1915. He was working at the very height of his powers and really inventing a cinema language at the time. And you can see that. And that is thrilling to watch. I was never bored. When I wasn't appalled, I was really kind of thrilled by what I was seeing. And it really had everything to do with the fact that you really have somebody really working with and inventing a kind of the tools of film. And it's not just that there's something quaint about that. It really is kind of thrilling to see it work. And the acting, which is, of course, very, very stagey, is just something that, because it's consistent and across the board, was very easy for me to get used to.
Mm-hmm.
And I found it actually very effective. I thought a lot of the acting was very good in its kind of, you know, very big staginess. But I really have to recommend that people see it. But the warnings are certainly out there. It's tough to sit through.
Well, your answer then, it seems to be, you can separate content from craft. And we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to answer that question. We're going to get a little more into detail on Birth of a Nation. And we'll share our favorite movie snoops, spies, and peeping toms. The top five is coming up next. Stay with us.
Don't give me any lip, son, or don't give me any grief. I've been around the block and back from Maine to Tenerife. Yeah, and I got my act together. Okay, it's just an act, but it served me well for a long, long time. And here's my secret, Jack. You need a real long finish that never quits. English treacle on harmony grits, a buttery flavor that goes on and on, with a hint of grease and a nose too long. But you got to do it your own way, on cigarettes and bad Chardonnay. Yes, cigarettes and bad Chardonnay.
It's time now to take a look at what's new on DVD, brought to you by PureFlix, a fun place to get movies for less. Discover, trade, connect at PureFlix.com.
Coming out this Tuesday on DVD, Short Bus, the John Cameron Mitchell directed film, one of Sam's favorite films of last year, another film I loved as well. Casino Royale, the new James Bond with Daniel Craig, I really liked it. Sam, not so much?
Right, that's right.
Okay, well, that's out in a two-disc special edition. Also out, an actor we love from The Prestige last year, Christian Bale, in a movie we overlooked Harsh Times, directed by David Ayers, I believe the screenwriter of Training Day.
That's right.
Did not see that film. I'm not sure I'm dying to see it, but it is out now for those of you who are curious.
I think I'm among the curious, yeah.
Okay. Well, we know Sam will be running down to the local store to get it then. But let's go ahead now and thank all of our listeners, Sam, who were so generous as to go to the filmspotting.net site and donate a few bucks our way via the PayPal links.
Yeah, our I think this is our second Platinum Club.
I believe so.
Platinum Plated Club member. It is Mark, A Century of Delight is his
name. Nicely done.
Gold Club member, former Platinum Club member, Paul, Symptoms of Majesty. I think we can just call him Big Papa or Sugar Daddy from now on. But also thanks to Aaron, Appalling Sunrise, Melissa, Trajectory of Remorse, and John, Earthworm Ottoman. Thanks to everybody that donated this week.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Sam, and in our last segment, we began to tackle Birth of a Nation, the first film in our six-week silent movies marathon. What a way to start out, Sam, with something as difficult to wrap yourself around as this film. And the question I asked you was, can craft, in this case, the technical innovations, the aesthetic achievement of this film, compensate for the fact that it is so racially offensive? And your answer was yes.
Yeah, and the answer was yes. I mean, ultimately, as just really mind-boggling as the racism is, it really just is so deeply troubling to see it depicted on screen. Just the sheer hatred that somebody would have to have in order to convey that on screen. And yet, I think it's still possible to really just be impressed with this kind of filmmaking and have that be the kind of prevailing feeling of the movie. It's not easy, but I think it's possible, and in that sense, I can recommend it.
Yeah, I think it's obviously possible because this film still remains such a revered film among critics and film historians, despite what everyone sees as so offensive about it. And I think that really the conundrum of it for us and for anyone who watches it can be summed up in the finale sequence that our listener John mentioned. It's really a testament to the power of cinema, I think, that the combination of cross-cutting and the staging of the scenes with the music that you get at the end of this film in particular, but there's some great sequences throughout, especially during the Civil War battle scenes, it does force you, in a way, against your will, to root for the KKK.
Yeah, it's just as really, that character. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's unbelievable because you've got four scenes that Griffith is capably cutting between, where some fugitive white men are being attacked in a cabin. This town of Piedmont is under attack from, literally, as they're called, crazy black men.
Yes.
You've got this one woman, Elsie, being forced to marry a mulatto, Silas Lynch, and then the KKK is riding triumphantly into town. These four things he's juggling so effectively, it's great filmmaking, and you can't stop yourself from being caught up in the moment and wanting, on some visceral level, for the men in hoods to make it to town and stop all of the chaos. It is naturally suspenseful, and then you catch yourself and realize the sheer horror of what you're watching.
And I think, and I want to be careful about how I defend this, but there is something about the fact that you're seeing something from a perspective that is so contrary to the prevailing notions of civil rights, of human rights, of humanity, that there is a kind of fascination in that.
Yeah.
It's so backwards that it's almost possible to ignore.
Yep.
It's not like it's subtle. It's not like the racism is subtle and it makes you uncomfortable. It's so over the top that it's just like, okay, well, that's what that is. And it doesn't even contribute to your insight into characters. It's just strictly drama at that point.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, this does recall other art like Leni Riefenstahl and some of her documentaries where people always talk about these things that are clearly offensive and yet artistically everyone appreciates them.
It's morally
corrupt, and like you're
saying,
the propaganda is so blatant that that is actually what makes it watchable in a way as a spectacle, because of the fact that if it was less in your face, if it was less propagandistic, then we would be probably railing against it. Like a film, and I hate to compare them, they're really not similar, but in this one comment I want to make here, we railed against a film like Jesus Camp, the documentary, for being too much propaganda, because the problem was we felt like we were being manipulated.
Yes.
The filmmakers wanted to be impartial and yet couldn't stop themselves
or have
from
the appearance of
the
impartiality.
Yeah, and at least here the whole time, even though there is a little bit of melodrama and there's a love story, that's there. But the fact is, this is blatantly propaganda that Griffith is giving us. And once you know that and accept it, then you can respect all of the other technical achievements that are going on. But you're right, especially when you get into the second half of this film, the war has ended, it's now the Reconstruction. I mean, you're literally going to see a black Senate, I guess, where black men are sitting around eating fried chicken and watermelon and have their feet up, and they're drinking liquor, and the text, the actual inner titles are mocking them,
right?
You know, are mocking the black men, and you get this scene with Gus, this lusty stereotype, this just totally hate-filled stereotype of a black man who chases around the young Cameron daughter Flora, and she's so unwilling to marry this guy, which is what he wants, that she kills herself.
Right.
I mean, it's really so bothersome. And
it's hysterical.
Same time,
I mean, hysteria.
It is.
Yeah.
It's totally hysterical. Yeah. And yet at the same time, the cutting of the three scenes, we get her running from Gus.
Yeah, your blood is pumping.
Yeah, and it is. And then also her brother, who ends up starting the Ku Klux Klan after this moment, you get the three of them in this sequence. And the way it's cut together is so fascinating that you can't help but be drawn into it, despite the fact that the whole time you're so hyper aware of how offensive it is.
And I want to point out that you mentioned this in the dope sheet. You're reading Mamet's new book, Bambi vs. Godzilla. And he talks a lot about exposition and this whole thing. And I certainly noticed it watching this film how well it dealt with exposition in some way. I mean, how few title cards really there are in a three-hour film. How willing it was to just trust the audience in terms of the action that was going on in these silent films. There's very little dialogue even that's like transmitted via title cards.
Yeah.
And I was just really, really impressed with that just in terms of the how concise everything was. These scenes are very short frequently, and they give so much information. And I don't know. It was exciting filmmaking to watch. I really feel like there's something to learn from it for contemporary filmmakers.
Yeah, there definitely is. And I just want to close by mentioning one shot, because I've talked a lot about the way the film is edited. But there's a shot where the little colonel, as Ben Cameron is referred to throughout the film after he achieves some status in the war, where he's leading his men on this final attack of Stoneman's army. And we get this high angle shot that's like a medium close up with Cameron and his men running toward the camera. And it's an amazing shot, frankly, today.
Yes.
And then you consider that it's 1915. I mean, it really does.
Incredible.
The moment you're watching it, you talk about kind of the blood boiling, your heart kind of pumping with the film. That shot takes you completely by surprise. It's so breathtaking in a way. And then you go, wait a second, this is 1915.
It's
amazing. We shouldn't be seeing shots like that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we will be moving on to our second film in the Silent Films Marathon, The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. We're going to German Expressionism, and I hope that will be less difficult to think about.
Boy, morally. Yeah, well, it was
Birth
a conundrum.
Yeah, so look forward to that next week. And we have one more bit of business we want to tie up before we move on to the top five, and that is real quick, Sam. You mentioned that I think your number four film that you were most embarrassed to admit you'd never seen was an 80s film, 16 Candles. And you were opening it up to me and the audience to get to pick what double feature, what other 80s film you had to see. And we got several emails with suggestions, including this one, Sam. Why don't you take it from Lex Tomaszewski?
Yeah, Lex, here are his suggestions about my cry for help, he writes. 80s films I need to see. Vacation, Fletch, Stripes, Spies Like Us, Weekend at Bernie's, Just One of the Guys, Police Academy 1 through 4, and Ferris Bueller's Day Off. I'll list three titles, one of which is going to shock you, Adam, that I have not seen. I think one of them I've already admitted to you. Vacation, I haven't seen. Just One of the Guys, a film I've never actually even heard of.
And I have seen.
Okay. The one that I haven't seen, that I know I now need to see, this is the second film, along with 16 Candles.
Okay.
Is Fletch.
Oh my God, you've never seen
one of my most
quotable films of all time,
Fletch. I've never been able to admit that to you.
Well, you know what, Sam, though? I actually don't know that I agree with that. Even though you need to see it,
really? Okay.
I don't consider it an 80s movie. And I think if you're going to be true to the 80s movie aesthetic, maybe a movie like Vacation, I'd rather have you go with a movie like Weird Science or Revenge of the Nerds.
Weird Science, so, you're right. I haven't seen either of those either.
There you go, Weird Science, one of my favorites. So anyway, Lex, thank you for the suggestions. Thank you to everyone who wrote in. We will continue to hash this out on future shows.
We'll figure out
what 80s movies Sam has to see. Which brings us finally to our top five. And this, of course, ties in with our review this week of The Lives of Others. Yeah. We thought about voyeurism, movies about watching or listening, about surveillance, spying. And Sam, why don't you go ahead and kick it off? How did you form your list? What was your number five?
Well, I think once I put the list together, I was really thinking about how not only The Lives of Others qualifies for this fact, but really all of these films are about paranoia in some way. Mm-hmm. And I feel like we've spent the first three films of 2007 talking about dealing with paranoia in some way, with Breach and with Zodiac, of course, and now with The Lives of Others. My number five, though, is a film we kind of split on. You liked more than I did, but it's certainly memorable in this case, is Michael Haneke's Cachet. This couple that's traumatized by someone who leaves videotapes monitoring their house, accompanied by these kind of freaky drawings. And in this case, we have a voyeur who reveals that he's a voyeur, but without revealing himself. And it's the voyeur as an aggressor in some way, which is unusual, as opposed to the secret passive mm-hmm. secret act. But certainly a memorable film. Certainly the voyeuristic aspects of that film are memorable.
I'm going to have to admit that when I first started thinking of this list, there was no way Cachet wasn't going in my top five. And yet here I am looking at all the movies I had to choose from. I completely overlooked it. So yeah. Nice choice by you, Sam, a film I definitely do love. My number five, though, is a film that ties in really well, a nice connection to Lives of Others, in that it is a Wim Wenders film, another German film from 1987, Wings of Desire, set in Berlin near the end of the Cold War. But you also have a story about a character who's an angel, Bruno Ganz is this angel, who makes the decision to stop being an observer and become an active participant in the world, which of course ties in nicely with what we discussed in Lives of Others. And like The Lives of Others, it's art in some way that propels him. He falls in love, and he falls in love with this trapeze artist, and her ability, her talent, is an art unto itself. The film is gorgeously shot by French cinematographer Henri Alacan and really relies heavily on shadows and switches between monochrome and color to separate the angel world from the mortal world. A brilliant film, Wings of Desire, my number five.
Good pick. All right. Well, my number four isn't maybe really obvious, but it is Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape, because, of course, the voyeuristic aspect really isn't so much in that people are admitting their sort of sexual fantasies or their mm-hmm. first sexual experiences to James Spader's character, but the voyeuristic quality is his enjoyment of that, his private enjoyment of people revealing these very personal aspects of it. So I think it does qualify, because it certainly does fulfill that idea of peering into somebody's secret life, which is certainly what James Spader, his surrogate for sex is actually mm-hmm. just hearing people talk about sex, and certainly memorable in that aspect.
Yeah, a great film, one I definitely considered for my list. My number four, though, is a film I can't believe we made it through a 15-minute or so discussion of The Lives of Others without mentioning its most direct relative, and that is Francis Ford Coppola's 1974 film, The Conversation. Wiesler's closest relative, certainly as a character, would be Gene Hackman's Harry Call. And he, like Wiesler, is pretty much antisocial, totally devoted to the work. He's the consummate professional, but becomes obsessed with a case he is working on where he is monitoring a couple. And he constantly plays their discussion in this crowded public place over and over again, trying to parse it for meaning. So like Lives of Others, it's about this search for truth, which I think you'll find a similarity there in all these films. But it's how a piece of audio or one phrase can have multiple meanings. Brilliant editing in this film and sound design by the great Walter Murch as well.
It's a great film. It's my number three, actually. I might as well just go with it. And it's true. It's like The Lives of Others. You can't help. Actually, it's funny. I didn't think of The Conversation during The Lives of Others. But as soon as I got to this list, it was, of course, the first film that came up. And yeah. The parallels are kind of shocking. I mean, they're so similar. And really, it is the fact that you have characters that are interpreting someone's reality mm-hmm. through sound alone. And really how that kind of warps their sensibility and their perspective.
Yeah. All right, well, my number three, I've got a tie here. I've got Kurosawa's film Rashomon and also the Errol Morris documentary, The Thin Blue Line. And Rashomon, like The Conversation, is about trying to find truth, but through the image or the visual instead of the oral, where we get to see a murder from the perspectives of four different people, the person who committed it, the victim, the victim's wife, and a witness. And, of course, all of their stories essentially contradict each other. So it's all about how these people view a certain event and then how we view their version of the event. A brilliant film. And then The Thin Blue Line is the Errol Morris documentary about the murder of a Texas police officer. And Morris tries to determine what really happened and whether the man who was convicted of the crime was guilty or not. and it's primarily built around eyewitness accounts, and he uses reenactments based on these testimonies to show us, the audience, all of the contradictions, building doubt in our minds as to whether or not this guy really could have done it. And it's a Philip Glass score, one that I think is actually perfect. So
you've been picking on Philip Glass for like four straight weeks. It's unreal.
Yeah.
All right, well, here's the really obvious pick everyone was waiting for. My number two is Rear Window, Alfred Hitchcock. The kind of idle voyeurism that we can all sort of be guilty of. And I think thinking of it in this context, of course, it's very obvious that that's what the film is about. But what a great, simple what-if kind of story it is. You know, what if the thing that I do, that we all do in some respect, is catch somebody in the act of doing something across the street in an apartment building and building off of that. And it's just, of course, brilliant for a number of reasons, but really just how we can relate as an audience, certainly, to what happens.
Sure. Great pick there. My number two, let's go ahead and hear a clip that I think will say it all.
What did you see tonight? Tell me.
I saw you come in. I saw you talk on the phone.
And then?
You got undressed.
Do you sneak in girls' apartment to see them get undressed?
No, never before this.
Get undressed. I want to see you.
Look, I'm sorry. Just let me leave.
No way! I want to see you get undressed!
That's a clip from David Lynch's film Blue Velvet, and it's Lynch, so of course it's all about what is going on underneath the surface, what we see and what we don't see, or what we see and what we choose to overlook because it's just too horrific. And of course, Jeffrey Beaumont, Kyle MacLachlan's character, has a line in there where he says, "I'm seeing something that was always hidden. I'm involved in a mystery. I'm learning." So it's about a character awakening to the reality of the world, the harshness of it, through his curiosity, by forcing himself to look at the world and what he has previously overlooked. One of my favorite films, Blue Velvet.
All right. Well, my number one, artificial intelligence as voyeur. Yes, my number one is 2001, A Space Odyssey. Really, I mean, one of the creepiest moments in film, Hal's lip reading of the fellow passengers on board the ship. And I think what's interesting about it is thinking of artificial intelligence as suffering from the weakest human tendencies in some way. I mean, if voyeurism, it really is this certainly this betrayal of trust and this sort of creepy tendency on the part of human beings for a machine to take on those tendencies is somehow doubly troubling.
Yeah. Okay. 2001, an interesting choice. I thought you might actually go with another sci-fi film, THX 1138, the George Lucas
point.
Film we both like, which does also fit into this category,
sure.
I think, a movie I considered. But we get on now to my number one, and let's go ahead and hear a scene.
How do you know there was a murder?
Because everything this fella's done has been suspicious. Trips at night and the rain and knives and saws and trunks with rope. And now this wife that isn't there anymore.
I admit it all has a mysterious sound.
Be any number of things. Murder's the least possible.
Now, Doyle, don't tell me he's an unemployed magician amusing the neighborhood with his sleight of hand. Now, don't tell me that.
It's too obvious and stupid a way to commit murder. Full view of 50 windows.
I strongly considered Vertigo, but Sam, you had it on there. It has to be with this top five, Rear Window. You cannot put together this list without including Hitchcock's classic film, where Jimmy Stewart does spend the entire film sitting in his apartment watching the people across the courtyard. And it's easy to think of the film as this non-sexual type of voyeurism, but this is Hitchcock, so the movie's filled with discussions of Jimmy Stewart's fear of marriage and commitment, and there's a lot of sexual innuendo. There's definitely a lot of psychological baggage that Hitchcock is exploring, and so that film, the ultimate voyeur movie, Jimmy Stewart, as I said, sitting in his wheelchair just watching what is going on and getting way too caught up in it. Again, another theme that overlaps with everything we've talked about, including the lives of others, people who end up becoming too involved in the subjects and the people they are supposed to be just passively watching. And like I mentioned, I really wanted to include Vertigo because the whole film is centered on Jimmy Stewart watching Kim Novak and then later taking the Judy Barton character and trying to make her match his image of Kim Novak's character. So either film could work here. You could go with a lot of Hitchcock films probably in this case. So Rear Window is my number one.
All right. Well, that is our top five. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message.
Opening in wide release this weekend, Oscar nominee Abigail Breslin in The Ultimate Gift, and in limited release, Miranair's The Namesake and Korean horror film The Host, which a couple of listeners have recommended to us, but the big release, of course, 300. We talked about it earlier. It will be the subject of our next review here on Film Spotting next week.
That's right. Check out the Top 5 Archive, a calendar of upcoming reviews and more at filmspotting.net. You can also sign up for the Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting Weekly email blast. Distributed through Public Radio Exchange, Film Spotting is available for broadcast on your local public radio station. Information is available on our website, filmspotting.net.
Thanks to Graham Parker and Bloodshot Records for today's music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is presented by the new PeerFlix. Discover, trade, connect at peerflix.com. And the winner is Lindsay McRae from Fairfax, Virginia.
All right.
Congratulations. What did you say?
I said, all right, like Matthew McConaughey.
Jesus. Let's do that again.